First and foremost, I'd like to thank the group for inviting me to share my, you know, experience, strength, and hope. It's an honor to be up here. It is in this place where I got sober. Downstairs is where I did my first fifth step, sitting on those elementary chairs for 7 hours. My teacher, who I believe is still in California, Al, told me to make sure to bring some food. I didn't bring enough. So I also want to congratulate the celebrants. Erica is somebody that I've gotten to know very well over the last couple of years. We are members of the same group on Friday night down in Somerville, and if you haven't checked that meeting out, she has taken that meeting to another level. It's a speaker, and then every other week someone is sharing on the steps. She's included prayers and everything else into that meeting, and the speaker that she had there last week was incredible. I'll talk about that person a little bit more. And Dave is somebody I've gotten to know, you know, over the time. He and I were both grieving around the same time with the loss of your mother and the loss of, you know, with my mom. And that bond that we have was immeasurable, and I thank you for that. And he is truly somebody that speaks AA very well. My sobriety date is January 2nd, 2000. When I first got sober, my sobriety date was January 1st, 2000. But I had to reflect on that. I drank on that day. So I pondered that, and I said, really the first day that I stopped drinking was January 2nd. And through the grace of God, I came into this fellowship, and I had to go out and do what I call R&D, research and destruction. I had, I guess, enough face to watch all of you go through that revolving door, and every time, every single person came back and said, it got worse and not better. My alcoholism, as I reflect on it now, I'm able to take a look at my past in a much clearer picture because I've had the opportunity to have a spiritual experience as a result of working these steps right out of the big book, exactly page by page with a teacher with exact experience, and could show me where the warnings were, where the promises were, where the directions were, when it was time to do the work, it was time to do the work. And I thank you. I thank Al, who is my original teacher for that. I thank Pete, and who is my current sponsor for that, and all the other teachers that I've had through my life, through up and downs, to get me through my fears. It started at age 5. It's going to sound like a Chris story, but I'm venturing out into the world. Johnny Obusick is my next door neighbor. We're both 5 years old. We're going to kindergarten. Did I say that right, Bridge?
No.
She says I always say kindergarten. Kindergarten. I have a problem with that word. We get on a bus. I think we did a trial run the day before, which is going to be a run of about 5 to 10 minutes. We're on the bus, and we realize that we're going to the wrong school. Okay? There was an elderly bus driver. My first experience with powerlessness and lack of control is that I'm demanding that he take us to the right school, and he could give a shit. Okay? He tells me to shut up and sit down. So I'm hysterical, as well as John is. We're to the wrong school. What happens the first day of school when you go to the wrong school? You go to the principal's office. First day of school ever in my career, I'm at the principal's office. I said, what did I do? Then I have to be driven to the other school, and I have to meet another principal. I don't know. Kindergarten is about an hour and a half, but it seemed like it was eternity to me. I had 100 forms of fear, everything else. I tell you that is because that became the thread of my life through my adolescence. I became an alcoholic well before I picked up the first drink. You know, during elementary school, I had this other guy, I can't remember his name, he threatened me with a knife on a daily basis during recess and scared the living hell out of me. So what did I do? I went home and told Dad. What does Dad tell you to do? Hey, buck up. Go after him. Dad, he's got a knife. So what? Take him on. I take him on. Somehow or another, I get the knife out of his pocket, beat him up. He becomes my best friend for the rest of my career in high school. Okay? Probably the one and only time before I drank alcohol that I faced my fear and did something about it. In third grade, I forget her name, heavyset Italian woman, And when I was thinking about this, Chris, I realized that I haven't finished all of my events. But I don't know where this person is. She pushed my desk up into the front of the school, on the front of the classroom next to her, almost on a daily basis. That was third grade, is when you learned how to, I guess you learned how to write, and somehow or another, I guess I wasn't doing too well. If she can hear me now, I make an amends to her now, you know, being critical and judgmental and gossiping about her, and I guess not following directions, you know. And if I was to shut up and ask her, is there anything else you want to tell me, she'd probably say, you were probably a pain in the ass. You know, and what would be my living amends? I'm going to pray for her now. I put her on my prayer list. So I hope that is good enough. I'll check with my teacher after the meeting. Maybe one of you gals is available for a surrogate amends. As time goes on, my life is twofolded. Most of the schoolwork I'm struggling with. I'm an average student. But I excel in the athletic field. Mom took care of the education and all that other good stuff. Dad took care of trying to make us men and teaching us sports. Anything that I did well, I took the challenge on, I practiced, I persevered, because I wanted to beat your ass. And we had a situation in my family. I'm the youngest of three brothers. They were pretty well known in the high school, so I had some sort of reputation to uphold. And the underlying fear and motivation in my life was to get love from my father that I thought I never got. I never once got him to say, I love you. There was only one time that he actually walked up to me and patted me on the back. You know, I'm playing all kinds of athletics. You know, I remember a particular game, I thought I had a pretty good baseball game, went 2 for 3, stole a base, scored a couple of runs, but he would point out, why did you do that during the game? And I did everything I could. I thought he didn't love me. I would go to Mom. She was kind of like my mentor. But I was feeling no control. I was feeling no love, almost to abandonment. And those of you who are out there that have done the 12 steps and have taken a look at, you know, those character defects that we look at in 4, 5, and 6, and 7, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So that was the riddle of my life. Anything that I couldn't do well, gymnastics, oh boy, wrestling, because I get pinned up with a guy in my senior year who was undefeated state champ. That was a lot of fun. Biology or chemistry, I ran from the hills on those kind of things. You know, if I had certain classes that I did well, like history, I immersed myself into it. You know, and like everybody else, I had problems with the opposite sex. I, you know, had no self-confidence. You know, and the one time that I stepped out from that, Linda Underwood in high school, who was the hot chick at a high school, she later became a Playboy bunny up at the old, up there in North Jersey. Yeah, right. Finally broke up with my high school athletic nemesis, Richie Pearman. So Brian walks up there and says, hey, you want to go out with me? No. Damn. So that shot me to hell, as you can see. So I didn't start drinking until 16. Actually, I experimented. We had a family affair. Parents and everybody else were upstairs. And I'm living in the house that I grew up in now. Some of the guys have been over to my house downstairs. We had this refrigerator, and Dad always had a stock of beer. So I found a shot glass, and we're going to do one shot a minute for as long as you could go. Some of you older guys remember that? Well, of course, in the beginning, one's not enough. So I'm doing one, two, three in the first minute. I go on for about 20 minutes, probably do a little less than three beers, and boom, I got that feeling. Not only was it that high feeling from the alcohol, you see, you have to understand that I'm all about control, and I'm all about being in charge, and I had the attention of everybody there, my cousins. I was the main attraction, I'm in control, and I'm loving it, and on top of that, this stuff is making me feel really good. So, from that point on, I liked it. I will tell you that for the most part, I did not like the taste of alcohol. I know there's somebody out there that loved that idea of a nice cold beer, you know, after you cut the grass. And me, when I looked at it, I drank for the effect. Just like it says in a doctor's opinion. That was me. And to see that when I started to go through the steps, bing, I went, wow, I drink for the effect. That's exactly me. And it was alcohol started to do for me. Started to make me feel almost like Don Juan to the ladies. It started to allow me to have more confidence. You know, I'm of the age that, you know, half of my senior year in high school, I was drinking legally. I was 18. My birthday is in January, which is only a couple of days from my sobriety day. We'll figure that. So I had a car, I had means, and in high school is when, at that point in time, after my baseball season, because I had admirations, and I did play a little college baseball, I thought I was going to be playing on a game of the week on Channel 4. Little did I know that wasn't going to happen. And I started to drink. And immediately, I knew I was always going to drink. I grew up in a drinking family. My dad, who I will not call an alcoholic, because he did stop. He was that character in the book. He did stop for medical reasons. I won't say he was the happiest character in the world after that, but he was able to stop. But I watched him drink, at least what I can remember, every day for about 30 years in a row, every day, 7 days a week. As a matter of fact, where I was going to elementary school, I run down the street there, and if I was quick enough, I would catch him driving his car on the way home because I knew where he was going. He was going to that liquor store to pick, and I would get a ride home. And I watched him. During the week, he drank 3 or 4 or 5 beers, have dinner, stop drinking. But on the weekend, he went crazy. And that's what I did. I became a weekend warrior. And it wasn't until I got into college that my drinking took on new proportions. We had a pub on campus. And except for a handful of people who were freshmen, everyone else could legally drink. Thursday night was drink to oblivion. You know, I would drink to oblivion, find my way back to my room, leave the keys in the doorway, and pass out my clothes. My roommates would take the key out, put it on my dresser, on my table, my desk, or whatever. And I had it, I don't know why, I was pretty stupid, I had an 8 o'clock class the next day, and more times than not, I went to that class without a shower in the clothes I wore in the night before. And it didn't matter. During my high school, I was pretty dedicated to my athletics, and that changed in college. I'm just amazed that my standards lowered enough that I went to a bar and got tipsy before baseball practice. I would never consider doing that. So my standards are getting lower. You know, I finally quit playing baseball because I told myself that I had to dedicate myself to school in order to graduate on time. Because after 2 years, I think I had maybe 50 credits. And I think, what is it, Bridge? We need about 130 to graduate somewhere. I had a lot of work to do. The truth was, and my whole life is being dishonest, the truth was, I didn't want to sit the bench. I never sat the bench before in my life. I hadn't experienced that in high school. It was not pleasant. I was an angry young man. And I knew that this guy, who was all conference, was going to play ahead of me. So what did I do? Just quit. You know, where it says in the book, you know, never made a decision. I just quit. Anything I didn't like, I just quit, or I just ran for the hills for it. Anything I did well or I liked, I immersed myself into it. You know, I get out of college, and I land this job that's not far from here called Bonnie Bray, where they're socially maladjusted and emotionally disturbed kids. Perfect. What's perfect about this job is that I work from 12 noon until 9 at night. Great, great job to drink. Okay? A couple times I had to throw up outside the gym before going into work. But, you know, it was like Fred Flintstone at 9 o'clock. We slide off the dinosaur, and where are we going? We are hitting all the places around here, driving like crazy, because that's what you did back in the day. You drove and drank, and the police just turned the eye to them. I thank God for that. I'm so blessed to be still standing here, because I've had horrific accidents with cars and everything else, and I could just see if I would have continued the path I would have been on, would have either killed myself or killed someone else. Drinking is going to a great proportion. I met these guys who loved the alcohol just as much as I did, and at every moment we would take umbrage and you know, succumb to it, and it was great. I traveled all through this state, going to one bar or another. There's very few bars in the state I don't think I've not been in. You know, being a member of a baseball team with guys living all over the place, we were all over the place. We traveled in pack. And my drinking became a problem. Finally, you know, I thought I found her. I was coerced into getting married. I was drinking with my future mother-in-law and my future wife. And my future mother-in-law looked at me and says, "So, when are you going to ask my daughter to get married?" I was like, "Oh boy." I did it half-assed. And there it was. We went off and we got married. And I won't say that I am divorced today. We had a lot of good times. But we had a lot of bad times. At the end, there were things that I'm not proud of that happened that caused that particular divorce. But the pleasure that I have on it, I have two girls, one who's here tonight, that are, you know, the epitome of my life today. And they mean everything to me. So it continued. I married a drinking partner. She drank just as much as I did, which was wonderful. And we went on binges like no one's business, and we surrounded ourselves with people just like us. Once we started a family, we couldn't just readily go out to bars, so we had the whoopee house parties, and my nickname was Bone Crusher. I'm a fairly big guy, and when I start drinking, I start dancing. And we had a room downstairs with a fireplace and with the stereo, and it was one of those times that I was passing out standing up. I had done this a few times, where I would just fall like a tree. Unfortunately, I fell in the direction of the dancing partner that was standing in front of me, knocked her down and landed on top of her. Out. Out. I landed. I was out. You know? I was overserved many, many, many times. I never made it to the end of the party. Just never made it. I would be face down on a carpet and people would step over me. And then I'd have to ask everybody what happened the night before. Then I was introduced to some non-conference stuff that allowed me to stay up all night. That was great. The only problem was that I believed that the more I drank, the sober I got. And I was the only one left standing. It was not good. It was not good. The end for my ex and I is that we took a trip to the Bahamas. My mother-in-law took 33 family members to the Bahamas to celebrate the millennium. And we were in a closed place where drink as much as you want. And that was fine for this alcoholic. Prior to that, my ex and I had been separating during this particular time, going to our own corners. And I always said to myself that I would never drink alone. Well, I didn't. At the end, I was drinking alone. all alone, downstairs, two bottles of wine, and God forgive anybody who came down, kids or my ex, because I turned into a fun drunk to a nasty. I became nasty at the end. And now alcohol was doing to me. You know, I had horrific experiences with drinking and driving. I had a couple friends of mine, and back in the day, I'm a salesman in the transportation or trucking business. And back in the day, they encouraged you to take customers out and entertain with them. And they gave me an expense account. And they gave me a company car. Not good for this alcoholic. So one night I had Yankee tickets. And I'm supposed to take customers. I invite three of my friends. But we go off to South Street Seaport first to get warmed up. You know? Well, we got warmed up. I got so warmed up I never made it to the game. One guy says, I finally have to go home. The other guy I rode in with me, and on the way back through the Lincoln Tunnel to get onto the turnpike, I guess I'm in near Sea Caucus, I'm blind drunk. I hit a parked car going somewhere between 35 and 40 miles an hour. There was a couple, I don't know if they were, having an intimate moment, I guess, or passed out themselves. The car was turned off, there was no lights, I never saw it until it was me to Chris away. Slammed on my brakes, it didn't matter. My first reaction, I got to get the hell out of here. My first reaction, not if you're okay, I got to get the hell out of here. I'm driving a company car, it's late at night, I've been drinking, I got to get out of here. I backed the car up, and I hit this car so hard, I didn't just dent the front of the car, I removed the entire grill. And the lights. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. You guys know that movie, Jim Carrey, Venture or whatever, with his head sticking out the window? I'm going from Sea Caucus back to Piscataway. No lights on the car, going down the turnpike with my head out the window. I can't imagine the thoughts with the toll collector when I took the ticket. I made it home. God's grace, I made it home. I parked the car. The next day, I called my company. You won't believe what happened. I parked my car in Jerome Avenue, went to the game, and somebody came and wrecked my car, and they took off. They bought the lie. My life was all about lies. Okay? Every time a question was asked or I was confronted, the answer was no. I was telling the opposite. It was so ingrained with me. I was so dishonest and so manipulative. I didn't know the truth to the lies it talks about in that book. Back in the day, this is before the cell phones, is when we had beepers. Friday night, our office or a terminal was right across the street from a bar. And I had a multitude of sales guys. And all it took was one guy to say, I'm going across the street. And we all went across the street. My ex is home with my kids and their babies. I'm drinking my face off. The beeper's going off and going off and going off. Aren't you going to call her? Why? Two things are going to happen. One, she's going to tell me to come home. And two, I got to stop drinking. And when I get home, I'm going to hear all kinds of hell. What hell with it? I'm going to hear it anyway. I'm going to stay here and drink. Not responsible. So I got home. There was another time I got home and she confronted me. You've been drinking? No! No! I would get into an argument with her so I'd go to bed early, sleep off my hangover, get up the next morning, go to work. Well, this one time she wrote me an apology. I took it to work and stapled it in the office. And I said, see here, guys? See what I got away with? That was my life. My life was so entwined with drinking, it was incredible. And I just couldn't see it. I just couldn't see it. I got a DWI. Would that stop me from drinking? No. Wouldn't happen until a year later. Until finally we came back from the Bahamas. And my ex had started to come into this particular fellowship and the other fellowship. And I had gone to some of the other meetings with her, and I said, I got to come up with something. I mean, this is not good, you know. So I walked up to her and I said, do you think I'm an alcoholic? Immediately she said yes. I went, shit. Meaning I have to do something about it. Quickly I said, well, maybe I'll go to a meeting. So I picked to go to Friday night meeting over in Bound Brook. Over at, if anybody knows that church, it looks like it's haunted. On Mountain Avenue, Route 28. I got the time of the meeting wrong. I think I showed up 45 minutes too early. There's one other guy, me and him. I didn't know you could have a meeting with just two people. He looked at me, I looked at him. I says, I don't know, I guess there's no meeting. January 6th is my birthday, which is the day of the epiphany. I had an epiphany. This was not like Brian. I walked out of that place and I had a meeting book. Okay, remember, this is before cell phones. Okay, and I called my ex and I said, I told her what happened, and I looked and I said, looks like there's another meeting over at Somerset Hospital at 8 o'clock. She's okay, go to that. I says, all right. First meeting I went to was down on Friday night. Somerset Hospital, it's a little bit different than Eric and the way you and I ran it. Back then, there were at least 100 people there. And it was a speaker meeting. I was given instructions. Sit back and listen. Identify, don't compare. Great stuff. But I felt like SH. And I'm looking across at this guy. And before the meeting, he's loud. He's laughing. He looks like he's having a good time. I can't remember his name. I know Pete, you would remember who it was. And I caught the resentment. How dare he be happy? Doesn't he know how miserable I am? This is unbelievable. But I sat through the meeting. I got a little bit of relief. I went home. The heat started. Now you understand the reason that I was going to the meetings to begin with, to get the heat off my back so I could what? Rejoin the family and drink. Because that's what I wanted to do. I had no plans of not drinking. I was just going to take a hiatus. I was going to go on holiday. I kept going to meetings. I get relief. I'm hearing things, which at the time was okay. Don't drink, go to meetings. Find a sponsor. Whatever. So I do that. And my first sponsor tells me to call him every day at 6:30. I don't know what we're going to talk about. We're going to call every day. You can't tell this undisciplined alcoholic what to do because he's not going to do it. I did it for a while and I said, you know, you're not giving me anything. So I stopped calling. Until one evening that I was getting quite close to that jumping off point. I called him late at night. I called him, must have been about 11 o'clock, 11:30. His wife answers the phone, I'm sorry. He has to get up early in the morning. He's already gone to bed. Why don't you call him in the morning? It was at that moment I needed help. Human failed me. I didn't have anything else. Second epiphany hit me. There's a gentleman that was a regular to this meeting who I worked with, who I know was in his fellowship. The next day I called him. He didn't tell me what to do. He says, I'm going to take you to a meeting on Tuesday night, which he brought me here. You know, because at that time, I realized in short order, just going to a meeting and not drinking did not work for this alcoholic. This is my experience. I got worse and not better. Yes, during that hour period of time, I felt safe and protected, you know. I checked my guns and everything else at the door. I was okay, but it was like going to a chiropractor. I get an adjustment, I walk out of there okay, and a couple hours later, I feel like shit. And that was my experience. And I was getting closer and closer to that drink. The epiphany, second epiphany that happened for me was I asked for help. That's something that the Donovan family doesn't do. We just don't ask for help. You know, I'll just muddle in not knowing what to do, but at least I look good. But I'm not going to ask you for help. My house is on fire, but I can't ask you for help. You know? That's changed, right, Mike? So that's the epiphany. My friend Gene brings me here. I'm introduced. Chris is here, of course. I'm introduced. Dave was here, but I didn't know Dave at that time. I'm introduced to this other gentleman, Dave F., and I sit and listen to the meeting. I don't ask me what went on in the meeting. I don't remember. I was too worried about me. After the meeting, we're out in the parking lot. He stands and he looks at me and he says, "What you want doesn't matter. Your job is to be a fit maximum service for your family. That's it." He was in a truck, I think, getting ready to go. But if anybody knows Dave, he's about 6'4". He weighs about 250, 255 pounds, much bigger than me. So I couldn't do the Irish thing, spit on my hands and go down when I was going to get my ass kicked. So I just had to. The reason that I was pissed at him is because he told me the truth. He laid it right between my eyes. And I needed somebody to do that for me. Because up until that point, it was just like, "You'll be okay. Just wait for the miracle to happen. Just keep going to a meeting. If you ask for them, I'll go." And it wasn't working for me. But I didn't know any better. I walked into this, and I saw people. I saw you all were different. People were downstairs taking people through the work. People are out in the hallway out there taking people through the work. You know, prayer and meditation was a part of this meeting. Multiple years of sobriety was a part of this meeting. I walked into my first AA meeting and he says, "You know, are you an alcoholic?" "Yeah, of course, what?" You know, I had no idea what an alcoholic was. None. You know, up until the first 6 to 9 months, I didn't know what it was. And so Dave stood there and stood in a circle, and him and his guys... And he just grabbed a hold of Al at the time and he said, "Here, this is your sponsor. Al, take him through to work." Al just told me where we were going to meet. And then we met down the street at the little cafe. I think it's different now. And he took me through the work, page by page by page. Now, I'm not convinced that I'm an alcoholic because my cycle is not drinking every day. I've heard so many stories around here, and that's some of you, that's your story, that you drank on a daily basis. I did not. You know, but I've heard Pete talk so many times about that cycle. One thing I can tell you, when I put alcohol into my system, all bets are off. I just didn't stop abruptly. I stopped when it ran out. I stopped when I passed out. Whatever that period is. You know, I heard in meetings, you know, some of the alcoholics go down far enough where they drink in the morning. I went, "That's not me." And someone pointed out to me, "Did you ever drink 3, 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning?" "Yeah, that's me." You know, I did that. One of the things, bless you, one of the things that melted it down for me. Can you stop and stay stopped? No. I had periods of intervals. I mean, I had one. I had this crazy idea that for Lent I was going to give up alcohol. I did. Except for 2 days. I forgot that St. Patrick's Day falls in Lent. I'm Irish. You cannot drink that day. And back then, my brother had an annual St. Patrick's Day party. He invited like 8,000 people. I got to drink that day. So, again, goes to that, made a decision but never stuck to it. It says in a book, in Bill's story, when he talked to Ebby, if you don't like your conception or their conception of God, choose one of your own. That melted a big thing for me because I'm an Irish Catholic and at age 16, I'm going left. And the church is right. I was emancipating myself, and in no uncertain terms, "Mom, Dad, I'm not going to church anymore." I mean, I walked around for an hour at times and didn't go. You know, church was all about, you know, We're going to take up a second collections for the flowers, and every time he got up on a pulpit, he's talking about dying. I'm 16 years old. I don't want to hear this nonsense. Check, please. I got to go. So I left. I was ready. I was emancipated. I can do this on my own. Little did I know, or my previous experiences that I did not heed, was not going to work out well, and I just explained those things to you. So my sponsor spent some time on that. Choose your own conception of God. Write it down. What is your conception of God? Not what he looks like. We're not concerned with that. Who is he? What do you want him to be? That melted some things down for me, because now I didn't have to live up to that organized religion. I will tell you today that organized religion and my spirituality have come closer. I see a connection between the two. You know, my belief back then was Old Testament, was the Ten Commandments, was Charlton Heston splitting the waters, and, you know, he was IBM and I'm little old me, and forget about it. He doesn't care about me. There's no way I'm making a connection to him. You know, I only did those foxhole prayers. You got to get me out of this jam. You know, I got the copier with the lights going, the car's wrecked, whatever. I got stuff in the car and I'm in trouble. So they helped him melt it away. And he explained to me what an alcoholic was. You know, it's a threefold disease. You know, you got this phenomenon of craving. When you take alcohol in your system, all bets are off. I says, that's me. You know, I got this mental obsession that the next time I'm gonna control and enjoy my drinking. It's gonna be different. I did all those things, it was gonna be different. It didn't work. You know? And my alcoholic thinking always took me back to a drink. Always. Friday night at the end of my career was the whoopee parties. And like I told you, I was Fred Flintstone. The problem with my mental obsession with those whoopee parties on Friday nights, they entered my mind on Monday afternoon and it consumed me until Friday. And it didn't matter that, you know, my family's home, I had to go. I had to go. I had to be there. I was important. I had to be there. I was going to miss something. I had to go. You know, I made deals. I took Bridget with me when she was this high to the parties, not knowing what she's doing or where she's at, and would have her on my lap so I could drive home the half a mile and help me to see the road. We've talked about that. I think we're over that now, but it, you know, so the damages that I did to my family were incredible. You know, that was my mental obsession, and I had no idea. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and I told everybody that I was emotionally bankrupt. I couldn't do this anymore. I didn't feel good about myself. I didn't have good internal condition. And little did I know, I was pretty close to what the spiritual malady was all about. It was an inside job. The inside of me was killing me. I was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. This is the way I dressed to go to work. And I wanted you to think that I was a professional. I had it all going on. Deep down inside, I was dying. I couldn't fix it. I couldn't ask for help. I just kept pouring it in, you know, and I was deceitful, manipulative, dishonest. I was a wreck. And so I became convinced that I was hopeless. Al helped me to see that I was hopeless in the first step, and I was beyond human power. He told me, he says, Brian, you can't get yourself sober, neither can I. That power has to come from somebody greater than you. You believe in God. I believed in God. But he's talking about a whole different gig here. He's talking about a relationship and forming a conception of that God. And he didn't say you need to do this here and now. Let's continue with the steps in the book. And that will formulate. When we got to the third step, made a decision to turn my will and life over to care of God as I understood him. Oh my God, what does that mean? I got to give up control? My four-step inventory had the word control at least 100 times. When I got to that fourth column, I was so ticked off after doing page and page and page. No control. I didn't want to do this work anymore. But that's the truth of it is. And I was like, okay. He simply said to me, finish the work. Give me a pack, you're going to do 4 through 9 to the best of your ability. And I did. I balked. I rested on my laurels. And he showed patience and kindness. He told me after there were at least 3 occasions that Dave told me to fire you. There were at least 2 occasions that I came to this meeting and I would walk in and Dave would grab a hold of me and say, what step you on? I'm on step 4. You were on step 4 last week. Yeah, I know. If you tell me step 4 next week, I'm bringing a bottle, I'm going to give it to you, I'm going to tell you on a parking lot and start drinking. That's the way he talked to me. That's the way my father talked to me. So it was okay. I guess. He scared the shit out of me enough to make me continue and finish it. And somewhere between the 3rd step and the 5th step, the obsession, the mental obsession, was lifted from me. It was gone.